Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani on the Progressive Radio Network at IE Green. And I'm so happy to be here with all of you today. I have a great show planned. My guests will be Stefan Schneider and Rachel Schneider. They are a power couple. They are the founders of the Hawthorne Valley Farm and the Institute for Mindful Agriculture. And they'll be coming on in just a little bit to talk to us about their roles in both of those organizations. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the news and share with you some events that you probably want to participate in. And of course, you also want to hear this week's recipe. So first, I'm sure many of you saw the front page of the New York Times on Monday, a plant-based diet is good for the planet, or good for fighting climate change. And, you know, this is something that we've been talking about a lot. There's so many reasons to cut down on our meat intake, but one of the main reasons is because the methane produced from all the meat production is just horrible for the greenhouse gas emissions and for the planet and global warming, not to mention our own health. So it's really a really impressive report. It was put out by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And they basically say that plant-based foods and sustainable animal source food is needed to free up several million square kilometers of land by 2050 and to cut the greenhouse gas emissions and the carbon dioxide equivalent. So it is just super, super important that we all take that to heed. But at the same time, you don't want to go turn around and start eating things like the Impossible Burger, which we know is filled with genetically modified ingredients. So when you are choosing plant-based alternatives, of course, we have our beans and our legumes, but also look at the ingredients that some of these plant-based alternatives have and make wise choices when finding those alternatives. Also, I wanted to share with you that the Trump administration, in their continued slashing of everything good, they have now proposed slashing the Endangered Species Act, which protects all of the animals that are endangered. And this, of course, would open up, make room for new oil mining and drilling and gas drilling and, put a green light on development in areas where these protected species live. And so it's just another one of the governmental agencies that he is rolling back the protections with. So, whatever we can do, I do have a petition on my website to donate to help protect the Endangered Species Act. And I ask all of you to take a look at my Take Action area on my website and get involved. I know I say this every week, and I'm going to say it again, that it's up to all of us to really stand up against what's going on in our country, whether it is climate change, abortion rights, vaccination rights, gun control. There's just so many issues that are really, really being slashed right now and are in the news, and we all really need to take a stand. We can't possibly do it all, so we all need to choose something that we're passionate about and go beyond our normal everyday doing what we do and reach out a little bit further, take that extra step, and become involved citizens to help make our planet better and to deal with the climate changes that are coming, because they are coming no matter what we do. And we have a choice as to how we welcome them, whether we do what we can to mitigate them or whether we just allow them to destroy the planet and humanity as we know it. So it's really our choice. And I know which I choose. So I choose to be active and to speak out and let my voice be heard. And I welcome all of you to join me. Lots of things going on in and around the city. Tonight, there is the Midsummer Beach Herb Walk with Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse. Ellen Kamai also has a radio show on this station, the Progressive Radio Network. And she is a wealth of information. I just love taking these herb walks with her, and you will learn so much. And it's free. It's this evening from 6 to 7:30 on Long Island in Oyster Bay. So you can find out more on my website. I have all of these events listed. Cornell Cooperative Extension is continuing their Garden to Table series. This coming Monday is the Freezer Berry Jam class, which should be really great. And then, of course, next Friday is the NOFA New York Gala, which I've been talking to you all about for weeks now. Isabella Rossellini is our guest speaker. She's an organic farmer and actress and filmmaker. Scott Chasky from the Peconic Land Trust and the farmer at Quail Hill Farm will be the masters of ceremony. Our guest today from Hawthorne Valley Farm are one of our sponsors of the gala. And it is just going to be a great evening, and we'd love to see many of you there. It will be taking place up in Poughkeepsie at the Locust Grove Estate. And it's Friday from 7 to 11. So I hope many of you can make it. Tickets are still available, but don't wait till the last minute because we do hope they will sell out. August 31st is the beginning of the Soil Saturdays that Hawthorne Valley Farm is sponsoring. And we will talk more about that when my guests come on. But basically, they are on Saturdays from 10 to 1. The event is free, but donations are welcome. September 8th is the 13th annual North Fork Foodie Tour, which takes place on Long Island. It is a self-guided tour of over 20 locations that represent a wide array of food producers on the North Fork. And you'll get to go behind the scenes, have tours of their farm and their food productions, and it's really a fun guided tour, and you'll certainly meet other foodies along the way. September 13th and 14th is the 5th annual Food Lab, which takes place at Stony Brook University's Southampton campus. You should see the lineup of that. There's so many great speakers there, so check that out. And September 14th is the Harvest Moon Evening of Expressive Agriculture at Augusti Farm. Augusti Farm is one of my favorite farms here on Long Island. They work with young adults and children on the spectrum and are doing a lot of work with agriculture and working with different challenges that people have. And it's great to see that happening and growing vegetables at the same time. It's really beautiful. September 26th, the Coalition for Healthy School Food is having their annual gala. In the past, they always had music, and this year they're having it as a comedy night. All joking aside, is the Healthy Food Gala's theme. And it's taking place at the Academy of Medicine, where it's been for a number of years now. I'm always there with a food table. It's all vegan. It's a wonderful night, and early bird tickets are on sale right now for $100. So get those if you can. And save the date for the New York Times Food Festival, which is coming up on October 5th. And now I want to share with you this week's recipe, which was the stuffed portobello mushrooms. You know, I don't grow my own mushrooms, but everything else in this dish I grow. Actually, not the walnuts either, but you know, I have so many greens coming out of the garden, and that just makes for a great stuffing of so many things. And I wanted, you know, a nice, satisfying main entree, and these stuffed portobello mushrooms really meet that need. So I used 4 large portobello mushrooms. I removed the stems, and I actually scooped out some of the brown part on the underbelly of the mushroom. I don't usually do that, but for some reason I wanted a little extra room to stuff them, so I did that. I used 1 onion that I diced. I used 1 long Japanese eggplant that I diced. And again, depending on the size of the eggplants, mine was really long, so 1 was enough. But if you have smaller ones, you could use 2. I used 2 teaspoons of minced garlic, 1/2 cup of diced Swiss chard. After I removed the stems, I chopped it up and I pressed down hard and I measured out 1/2 cup. And 1/4 or 1/4 cup of chopped sage leaves, 2 cups of chopped greens. I'm sorry, 1/2 cup of diced Swiss chard stems. That's the stem parts of the Swiss chard. And then I have 2 cups of chopped greens. And I did a mixture of Swiss chard and kale. And again, I chopped it up really fine. And then I pressed it down into a measuring cup. So the 2 cups, you know, if I hadn't pressed it down, would easily have been 3 or 4 cups. 3/4 cup of diced assorted peppers. I have red and purple and green growing right now. So I used all of those. Some olive oil just for some sauteing. 1/4 teaspoon of salt and 1/8 teaspoon pepper. 1/2 cup of white wine, 2 tablespoons tamari, 1/2 teaspoon of dried tarragon. If you have fresh tarragon, please use that. 3/4 cup of chopped walnuts and 2 tablespoons of chopped parsley that I use mostly for garnish. And if you are not vegan and you would like to add some cheddar cheese or Gruyere cheese on top of these at the very end, you can do that. It's kind of nice because you can leave it out and just, you know, put it on whoever's mushroom wants the cheese. So I started by wiping the mushrooms with a damp cloth. You don't ever want to run mushrooms right under the water. They just absorb too much of the water and then they just get soggy. So you just really want to wipe them with a damp cloth. And I, like, as I said, I scooped out the dark underside of the mushroom to make the stuffing fit in there just a little bit better. I chopped the stems from the mushrooms and I set those aside and I used those in the stuffing as well. And then in a heavy skillet, I sauteed the onions in just a little bit of olive oil for about 5 minutes until translucent. Then I added the garlic, the mushroom stems, and the eggplant and sauteed for about 5 more minutes. And then I added the charred stems and cooked for another 5 minutes. And as I was cooking it, I was tempted to want to add more oil, but I didn't. Instead, I added 1 tablespoon at a time of water. And you can actually saute using water instead of oil, and this cuts down a lot on the amount of fat in the recipe. So I continued sauteing using the oil. Then I pushed all the vegetables to the outer rim of the skillet. Again, I try to use as few pots and pans as possible so that the center part of the skillet was empty. I added a little bit more olive oil, waited till it started shimmering and got hot, and then I added 1/2 cup of chopped sage leaves. And I wanted the sage leaves to crispen up a little bit. So I just let them brown for a few minutes. Then I added the peppers and continued cooking all of it until it was soft. Then I added 2 cups of greens, the white wine, the tamari, and the tarragon, and the salt and pepper, and let that get sauteed. And the greens, you know, instantly start steaming in the white wine and really reduce in size quite a bit. Then I added the chopped walnuts and some of the parsley. I saved some of the parsley for garnish. Well, I guess I put 2 tablespoons of parsley in it, and then I had some extra parsley for the garnish. And then you just taste the stuffing. You know, see if you want to add any more tamari or any more salt. That's up to you. Then I stuffed the mushrooms with that stuffing, and I baked the mushrooms for about 20 to 25 minutes in the oven. And I covered them so that they wouldn't dry out too much. And then at the very end, I took the cover off and cooked it just for a little bit more time. And if you want, when you take the cover off, that's when you can add the cheese, if you are going to add any cheese to it. And then I removed, after the cheese was melted or I cooked for another 5 minutes, I removed the mushrooms from the oven and I placed them on a serving platter and garnished with some more fresh parsley. And they just were delicious. I could have eaten more. I only made one per person. And for a main course, you'd probably want 2 per person. But they were wonderful as a side dish as well. So now it is my pleasure to introduce my 2 guests to all of you. Stephen Schneider has over 3 decades of experience as a biodynamic farmer and herdsman. He's currently the director of farming operations at Hawthorne Valley Farm and co-founder of the Institute of Mindful Agriculture. He holds a master's degree in agriculture from the Justin von Liebig University in Gießen, Germany. And forgive me if I've pronounced that incorrectly. And since 2007, he's been on the board of directors of the Biodynamic Association of North America, and he's currently the president of that organization. Stefan has keynoted national and international biodynamic conferences around the world, and including Switzerland and New Zealand. And he conducts workshops on organic and biodynamic farming all around at conferences in the U.S., China, Switzerland, and New Zealand. He's a member of the faculty at the Hawthorne Valley Farm Learning Center and serves as an adjunct faculty at the Pfeiffer Center in Spring Valley, New York. And his wife, Rachel, is the director of the Hawthorne Valley Farm Place-Based Learning Center, which focuses on farm-based educational programming for children and families and professional training in the vocation of agriculture. She's also the co-founder of the Institute for Mindful Agriculture and holds a master's degree in Waldorf Education. And as part of her work at the Learning Center, Rachel brought the Farm Beginnings Whole Farm Planning Program to the Hudson Valley from its original home with the Land Stewardship Project in Minnesota. She has organized a yearly biodynamic winter intensive training program at the Hawthorne Valley Farm and developed and initiated the Kids Can Cook Summer Camp, which is specifically targeted to serve underserved children in the Hudson Valley community. Her most recent projects include creating curriculum for the Real Food Business Planning course and working with the Bard Prison Initiative to bring a lecture series on the emerging real food economy to inmates at the Woodbourne Correctional Facility in Sullivan County. And Rachel's been part of the management at Hawthorne Valley Farm for the past 20 years. And prior to that, her current role, she held the position of market gardener and CSA coordinator for the Hawthorne Valley Farm. And I'm so happy to have both of them joining me today. Welcome, Rachel and Stefan.
Thank you, Bhavani. That is very kind. And thanks for having us. And that recipe is delicious. I think I'm going to have to try that out myself.
Yeah, sounded great. So glad to be with you, Bhavani.
One tiny correction, Bhavani. I'm currently not on the board of the Biodynamic Association anymore. My term was up.
Ah. Thank you for letting me know. You might want to update that on the website.
Yes.
I thought before we really get into the Institute for Mindful Agriculture, just for my listeners who might not know the difference between biodynamic and just organic, I mean, I sometimes tell people, you know, biodynamic is kind of like organic on steroids. But maybe you can, just quickly give a little synopsis of biodynamic.
Sure, yes. The way you describe it is not, I think, is an interesting way, and I think not a wrong way of describing it. But I think the difference that the way I would describe it is that, for one, I think biodynamic is the oldest organic biodynamic movement. It's been around for almost 100 years, so it sort of predates organic, so to speak, and picks up on what all agriculture used to be, which is organic. And I think its key elements are to really recognize that for a farm to be regenerative and successful, it needs to be a self-sustaining organism. So you need to have a diverse farm with livestock and cropping, and pretty much can create all the inputs that you need on the farm itself. And then on top of that, we are very aware in biodynamics that the farm is tied into a much larger context, so we try to pay attention to cosmic rhythms, and we use certain homeopathic substances to enhance these rhythms and enhance certain aspects of the farm, like soil life and ripening qualities.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. That's very helpful. So when did your farm, the Hawthorne Valley Farm, get established? When did you start that?
The farm here started in the mid-70s, 1976, I would say, the farm got its start up here in the Hudson Valley.
Uh-huh. And you've been involved since the beginning?
No, we've been involved. We actually were both here in 1980, and then we've been here full-time since 1989.
Okay, that helps me. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about your new project, the Institute of Mindful Agriculture, or Institute for Mindful Agriculture, forgive me. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, I'd love to. So basically, this latest project of ours, the Institute for Mindful Agriculture, is a building on our career at Hawthorne Valley. I think our work with Biodynamics and also with an organization that I got to know about 7 years ago, it's called the Presencing Institute, which is located in Boston at MIT. And all this put together, I think, made us realize that we as a global community face some major challenges. And one way to sort of highlight these challenges is you could say there's like three areas of major disconnects in our current world. And one is we are sort of disconnected from our natural world, from the living Earth, because we're using her up faster than she can regenerate. So there's a disconnect there. Then there's a disconnect amongst ourselves in communities that are falling apart. And one metric of that is the tremendous economic disparities that exist in this country and worldwide. And lastly, another disconnect is something that many of us experienced within ourselves, and that kind of is you can measure by, you know, the rates of mental health being an issue, burnout, depression, all the way to suicide becoming has become a major issue. And what we realized is that I think a more mindful agriculture can help heal a lot of those disconnects, and that's kind of at the base. That was sort of the base idea behind founding this impulse. We felt that all these three disconnects can find healing by looking at agriculture and practicing it in a different way.
Yes, I think you're so right. I've seen so much work. I know you heard me mention Augusti Farm, who's working with, you know, young adults on the spectrum. And there's another farm out here working with autistic kids. And I just know, you know, suicide is like the largest cause of death amongst teenagers, I believe, at this point. It's just, you know, you're just hearing about anxiety and depression and opioids, and you know, everybody is just really struggling right now. So I know when I'm stressed, there's nothing like going out to the garden and, you know, picking some vegetables or even just weeding. You know, that just that act of having your hands in the soil and hearing the sounds of the planet.
It's almost magic, the effect that it has on all of us.
I also think that is such a key idea, that agriculture has this cultural aspect, that we can look at our society through the lens of agriculture, and that doesn't only mean large industrial agriculture. It means a way, a potential way to connect to ourselves, but also to provide healthy food through food access that's available to all, to solve the question of hunger, unhealthiness in the food system, a more mindful look at how we grow the food and how we distribute the food to one another, to be really inclusive of one another, is another lens on the question of inequality and income. And then finally, of course, our current more industrial methods are doing tremendous harm to our Earth. People know that. They've become intensely aware of that. So the healing, if you want, that needs to go on for our Earth, toward one another, in our economy, and even, as you say, within ourselves, we feel like agriculture can have a central role to play in those reconnections of the disconnects if we learn how to work with agriculture in a new way with a new narrative.
Mm-hmm. I think you're so right. The current state of food and farming, where would you say that's at?
Well, I'll just carry on here for a moment, Bhavani, by saying, I mean, we know that there's widespread conventional, industrial, and global agriculture, global movement of food through global agriculture. That exists. You know, Stefan and I just took an 8,000-mile trip around this country, and we have large tracts of land in Montana, in Minnesota and Idaho. I mean, really enormous tracts of land that are capable of growing large amounts of food. So we know that that exists, but we also know that there are pockets all over the country right now, whether we're talking about the Northeast or California, but also parts of Iowa, parts of Louisville, Kentucky, parts of the Southwest, certainly around Oregon and that, and parts of the Northwest, where people are waking up to the idea of smaller holdings that can also provide food for more local or regional communities. So I would say that the current climate in agriculture, I don't want it to be a polarity. I would like to see how we can knit together agriculture that is aware of local and regional needs and organizing itself into food sheds to as much as possible sustain local and regional communities and then look outward from there to larger farms. I do feel one of the things we have to really look at is the use of pesticides and herbicides and chemical fertilization. There are large parts of even, we kind of heard it at a conference we were at in North Dakota, where extension people are saying, hey, we're wrecking our soils. We have to do something. So that's, a problem unto itself, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think also people have been being told for so long that we need this industrial agricultural model in order to feed our growing population. And in reality, that's not proving to be accurate. We see that, you know, over 70% of the world's population is being fed by small family farms, and that the industrial agricultural model is really not fulfilling the promises that it made. And it's really degrading our soil much more than helping.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's really, I think, more and more recognized overall, and it's an interesting phenomenon, because I think it's sort of a sign of when you ask the wrong questions, you go down the wrong path. So I think the question of what's driving our agriculture is we need to feed the world is the wrong question. I think it starts out with we need to feed our local communities and then grow out from there, because when you drive through these industrial agricultural landscapes, the local economies and the local communities have been are suffering and are dying. And so clearly we have to turn this around. And the other thing that sort of modern science has shown us is this amazing intricate connection between a healthy soil biome and the microbiome that lives in our guts, all of us, and how important that is for our overall well-being. And I think the more we can really understand that and learn about it, it'll become hopefully then a natural progression that we will stay away from all these toxic substances, and I think agriculture will find a better frame again. And maybe the last thing I would say is when you talk about these small holdings globally that are really doing the hard work feeding most human beings, you know, the UN did a report, I think also about 7-10 years ago, where they really, what they coined as the key feature of agriculture, that their term was, agriculture is multifunctional. In other words, it's not just about growing food. There's ecological consequences, there's economic implications, there's cultural implications. And they said, unless we really reinstate this multifunctional characteristic of agriculture, we're going to be in trouble. And so that's another word, maybe a little drier word, but when we say mindful agriculture, that's kind of what we have in the back of our minds, that agriculture is really a lot more encompassing than just growing food, and sadly, the policy is it needs to be cheap food.
Right, the whole true cost of food. And
exactly.
The true cost of food, if people were held responsible for cleaning up behind themselves. So can you share with us your framework of working with food shed members? How do you go about that, and how do you build food shed members in a local regional area?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it's all, you know, that's kind of like another, the reason we sort of talk about food sheds is that it's, you know, it obviously is a takeoff on the word watershed, where the water connects large swaths of landscapes. And I think what our current economic and agricultural model has achieved is it has completely disconnected the various stations of food from soil all the way to somebody's refrigerator, that there's no conscious connection and collaboration along that food value chain. And so I think what we need to relearn is, well, how do we reestablish these connections in food sheds of the future? And so one framework that we're using is takes its cues from soil, because it's interesting that in my mind, these three divides that we discussed in the beginning, each one of them has sort of an area that's invisible but essential to its well-being. So clearly the natural environment, we're all learning now how important it is to really focus our work on creating soil health through our agricultural practices. And soil is mostly invisible to us, but we all learn more and more how important it is. And we believe actually there's three areas that you could use the soil as a metaphor. And so we talk about soils out in our landscapes, and we all can take responsibility there as farmers, obviously very directly, as eaters by our choices. But then there's also, I feel, something within each one of us that we call inner soil. And in my mind, it's not coincidental that soul and soil are very closely related as words. And so each one of us has this invisible area in lives in me, and I need to take care of its fertility and its vibrancy, and there's practices to do that. And then in the economy, which is all about relationships, there is what we call social soil. So that's something that you cultivate in any kind of group or team. And like all good soil work, it needs ongoing awareness and ongoing practices to cultivate its fertility, so to speak. So that's one framework we use, and then apply that in different ways, and depending on what area we work at. Do we work with eaters? Do we work with farmers? Do we work with retailers, et cetera, et cetera? So that's kind of how we try to weave this food shed slowly, with obviously collaborating with many other individuals and organizations.
Have you seen much of a change? You've been doing this for so long. Have you seen a big change recently in people's openness to regenerative agriculture and establishing these more local economy food sheds?
Absolutely. There's from 2006 is the date that Stefan and I reckon with the omnivore, with the publication of the Omnivore's Dilemma, the huge, what we felt was a kind of awakening on the part of the public around food, food access, healthy food, how we organize the food system, and what kind of practices are we using. That was a seminal point. Prior to that, I mean, Hawthorne Valley, as Stefan mentioned, has been trafficking in these radical concepts, if you want, since we began in the 70s. And, of course, all our brothers and sisters in the organic food movement have also been doing that since the 70s. But for the general waking up of the public from 2006 on, it's really, really grown. And we have developed relationships with, like, NOFA New York and Stone Barns and Glenwood and all the local farmers that are part of our county that are sustainable farmers. We've been doing that kind of relationship building for years. But we do see more and more, and we are involved more and more, with groups of organizations that now realize that we have to take the next step in developing almost the threads that bind us as a region, and much of our work with the projects that we do that we'll describe more as we go along becomes more involved with collaborative action amongst organizations to develop these regional food sheds. I would say we spent quite a bit of time in the past 30 years developing our organizations or our farms, or and now we're at a next phase of trying to integrate our work in our region, which is the Hudson Valley region.
I see that here on Long Island, too. There's so many different groups doing good work, and a lot of us are spinning our wheels and overlapping, and we need to really, you know, and there is work in that direction as well, bring us together so that we are more powerful because we're collaborating and our power together is much more, will be much more successful and have a greater impact than each of us individually.
I think, Vavani, I think that is such a good and critical point, and I think that's really the next step that we have to do, that we have to take as individuals really concerned about the current state around of our Earth, really, and of ourselves as humankind. It's, we have to learn to collaborate on this meta level, and you know that takes, I think, and again, that's an area where this what we call social soil becomes a critical element to tie that together appropriately to really make sure that there is the right amount of give and take. There's probably some languaging that one has to all learn together. And really we have to, you know, one thing that I've sort of come to recognize over the course of this work is how important and how often overlooked listening, real quality listening is. And it's a skill that is sadly gone missing in our culture to a large degree. So just learning how to really listen to one another and then speak to one another, I think, will hopefully enable us to get to that stage that you described, because I think if we don't achieve that, it's going to probably be not enough.
I would just add there, Barani, that I agree 100% collaboration amongst us all is what is needed. What's held us back, I think, is this question of how do you facilitate forward movement with a group of organizations, let's say. And what I've noticed at the same time since like 2010 on is the flourishing of facilitation and group process as an actual technique. There are techniques now, whether you deal with a World Cafe or the Presencing Institute toolkits for how you run a case clinic, or it's a whole realm that someone can be actually have as a profession to help us have structured conversations that move the dial forward.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're so right. Also, one of the things that I had found in the past, I think so many organizations were, you know, I don't know if an organization can have an ego, but, you know, each organization wanted the credit for what they were doing, and they didn't want right. to give that up. And so I think, you know, in collaboration, it's not so one as much as the region, and you're all in it together. And I think that's, you know, something that a lot of organizations have to work with, like what's more important, your ultimate goal of getting where you want to be or getting credit for what your part is, you know?
I also want to add here, and we cannot forget this, and this is emerging very quickly now, there are farmers of color all around us who have never had an organization or a voice that really could enter them into the dialogue of how we're conducting our agriculture and our food systems here in the Hudson Valley. That is changing. Grow NYC has done tremendous work with farm workers and people of color and immigrants to bring those farmers into the discussion. Farm School New York City is another incredible organization that I want to name as helping with this question of bringing farmers of color into the Hudson Valley. And, of course, Soulfire Farm is incredible. We've known Leah and Jonah for a number of years. I cannot say enough about how they are helping people, young people of color, interested in farming and immersing them in both the techniques of small to mid-scale farming, but also their own cultural heritage, that restoring that to the dignity that it actually deserves. So I just want to say that we need to really be mindful of this whole movement as well. It's growing.
Absolutely. And I know you have some workshops coming up on the three soils. Can you talk a little bit about how you have those workshops planned out and what people who would be taking them would be learning?
Sure, I can try. I mean, so you already kindly mentioned in your in introduction that we have the first of our Soil Saturday series starting at the end of August, and then we'll have two more sessions, one on September 28th and one on October 26th. And basically, the way we work there is we want to invite anybody interested into Hawthorne Valley Farm, and then we will open up some of these areas that often aren't seen that make a farm successful, though. So one is let's look at soil. Let's dig into the soil and take a look at it, see what's alive, see what we can find, and compare it in various areas of the farm to really get a feeling, smell it, feel it, touch it. And so that's one approach that we're taking. And then, for example, let's dig up a clover plant and see what's going on those roots. Something very magical is going on there that is essential for soil health. Let's look at a compost pile. What's going on there? So there's various areas when we go through the farm where we can focus our attention to parts that you can't really see but that are really important. So, you know, in like I said, these three soils are kind of invisible mostly to our eye. And then in the process of doing that, I think what will happen is that something inside of us will possibly awaken, and we might shine a light on that and encourage ourselves to do a little self-observation and might, have a conversation around that. So that's one way we're gonna we will approach it, to really mm-hmm. make the farm a lab in that sense, to look at these various areas. Another one that we'll do in the winter, in February, we don't have an exact date yet, it'll be the second half of February, we'll actually have a several-day workshop where we look at comprehensive soil health and invite some specialists in, some really experienced people agriculturally and from a soil testing point of view, to really look at soil. But we will then also really delve deeper into, well, what do we see in ourselves that is an inner soil, and do some sort of practices and exercises in sort of becoming aware of the social soil area. We will, you know, how do we listen to one another? How is that different one way or another? How do we speak to one another? So those are examples of programs or offerings that we would share with anybody who is interested, and sort of shine a light on these areas and have them integrated. Then there's obviously these other walks that are based on the Japanese practice of Shinrin Yoku, what you, I think, translate as forest bathing. Another amazing sort of experience of what's alive in a forest and how that can really rejuvenate us when we tune our senses, our various senses, to all those activities that you can pick up in a forest. So these are just some examples.
We will be doing mm-hmm. that, some examples of what Stefan is talking about, both with the natural soil, with how we speak with one another, and then with the forest bathing workshop in is part of our biodynamic, or as part of our soil workshop in the winter, and also potentially with the three soils, soil mm-hmm. Saturdays. So mm-hmm. that's kind of almost like a template, I would say, or a framework. We always address all three soils. We try to work with them in programming. But we also have several projects that we're doing out of our work at the Institute for Mindful Agriculture. And I just want to give a moment to both the Rolling Grocer and the work we're doing in Chester Ag Center, if we have time for that.
Sure. Tell us about the Rolling Grocer. I love that project.
But Bhavani, before we go there, just one more thing I want to mention, because we've talked a lot about soils. We talked about forest bathing, and also sort of relating it to your intro around animals and livestock. Another thing that we all probably know out of our own experience is, so at Hawthorne Valley, we have a number of different animals that are helping us. And in my mind, the cow or the ruminant is a sort of a very essential partner in building soil health. So on some of these experiences, we'll also allow ourselves to get to know these amazing beings a little closer. There was recently an article in New York Times on cow therapy. I don't know if you've seen it, but for many of us, we've become so disconnected that being close to a being like a cow can have a real beneficial therapeutic effect. So all these are all activities that we'll weave together in a way that they're really hopefully supporting our well-being and feeling good.
And also, mm-hmm. I would just ask for anyone who's interested, on our website, we are starting the Institute for Mindful Agriculture.org. We have started a series of animal meditations, I would say. And the first one we started with was the cow. So if you go to our website, you will hear our colleague, our wonderful colleague, Jill Jacobus, a young researcher who has done an exemplary job with our first attempt at getting closer to a cow in a virtual setting of a short audio that she audio tape that she has on the website.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I have been meditating myself for years, and the idea of animal meditations really intrigues me. I like that. So let's, can we go back to the Rolling Grocer? Can you
Absolutely.
Talk to us about that project?
Yes, I'm happy to do that. And so you could say that the work of the Institute for Mindful Agriculture centers around programming, which we've been describing, projects that we have out in the world there, and our own research. And in terms of projects, I just wanted to share three. One is the Rolling Grocer, which came about as a collaboration with Long Table Harvest, which is a gleaning organization that goes around Columbia County, gets gleaned food from the farmers and delivers it to food pantries, and Hawthorne Valley Association. We applied for a grant that was put out by the Berkshire Taconic Community Foundation, a wonderful grant that wanted to look at food access for Columbia County, wanted us to be able to find a way to give emergency food out, but also find a solution for the inequality in food access for people based on either whatever their circumstances are, lack of income, where they're located in a geographical area, their age and inability to move around. So we did some research, and our grant proposal, which was an ongoing for a five-year period, we determined that how we wanted to understand what each community that we were working with or trying to work with in Columbia County needed was not for us to go in with a potential solution from what we had researched, but for us to form a core group of individuals who we would help to support to become food activists and really listen to what their needs are and then build a project out of that. And so what happened for us in the city of Hudson, for example, which is an acknowledged food desert, or as my which is an acknowledged food desert, is that we formed a core group representative of the different communities in Hudson that are part of the Hudson citizenry. So we had citizens from the, there's a strong Bangladeshi community in Hudson, African American community, a Latinx community, an Anglo community, and we had representatives from each of those groups of people, and they told us what they needed living in Hudson, what would help them the most. They needed to not have to go long distances. Some of them didn't have cars and couldn't get out, or they had a car, it was shared with a partner for work. And so they, if they couldn't have a storefront in Hudson, which had never been possible, just couldn't happen, they wanted a mobile grocery store. And so we, together, over 2 years, built one, called it the Rolling Grocer, and it did roll down the streets of Hudson. We were able to supply people with fresh and healthy food, much of it organic, and we developed a three-tiered pricing system. Based on your income, you self-declared, no proving of anything, and so every item on our mobile market had three prices, blue, orange, green. That's how they were tagged. And depending on your income, you would come into our POS system, and your food, when you said your number or your name or whatever, would come up at that price, and that's how we charged you. Eventually, this year, we did, were able to have a storefront, still based on the three-tiered pricing system. And it's working wonderfully for Hudson. And right now, we're also resuscitating the mobile aspect, which we had to stop for the winter. And we're going to bring it to other parts of Columbia County. So that's one. We started a second core group in New Lebanon, and we're working with them in a similar way. And our intention is to be able to touch different parts of our county, either through the mobile market or through storefronts. The last thing I want to say is that we could not do this without Hawthorne Valley Farm Store, which is a large retail store that's almost like an anchor for all our purchases. We attach our purchases for groceries and other items, and we go through Hawthorne Valley Farm Store, and we get excellent prices because they are much larger. They're able to buy through volume, and they don't charge us for that. So it's a model where you need to anchor your efforts with a small storefront that's nimble, doesn't have the overhead of a large store, but is being supported by a large store. And so that's how our Rolling Grocer has been working.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And we're almost out of time, but there's so many other things I wanted to ask you. I wanted to ask you, are you still doing your prison program?
I was going to say that we actually worked with a wonderful farm that I wanted to give a shout out to, Rise and Root Farm, Karen Washington, Lori Clevenger, Jane Hodge, and Michaela Hayes, and all the people of Rise and Root. And we.
Okay, so Rachel, what we were just talking about.
Also, you guys. I was asking about the prison project.
Yeah. So I just wanted to add that we were working on the prison project with folks from Rise and Root Farm, which is part of the Chester Agricultural Center. They have taken on moving that project forward, and that is very exciting for us to know that when we work with a group of people and then they're able to take the project further, that's, that's real collaboration. And Rise and Root is part of the Chester Agriculture Center, which is almost 190 acres now of black dirt in Orange County. And that's another one of our projects. We're helping them develop their entire farm so that it open to beginning farmers to have a place to start their farms, to work with farm workers, to have develop processing and maybe a food hub of their own. So those are two of our projects that we're working on.
That's great. And we are just about out of time. I'm so sorry, but I wish I could keep talking. But I would love you to just share your contacts if anybody has any questions about the Institute for Mindful Agriculture, how they would find you and get in touch.
Yeah, thank you so much, Bhavani. So the easiest way to get in, there's two ways that is to get in touch. One is you go to the website of the Hawthorne Valley Farm, and there you'll find a link to the Institute for Mindful Agriculture, or you could go directly to our website, which is the whole word spelled out, instituteformindfulagriculture.org. And there's a contact me button, and we look forward to hearing from as many of you as feel called to be in touch and continue the conversation.
Wonderful. Well, I want to just thank you on behalf of myself and all of the eaters out there that care about our food. Thank you both so much for the work that you do. It's really so important, and it's really appreciated by those of us that care. So thank you. And everyone who's been joining us out there, thank you for listening. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green, and I'll see you again next week. Bye for now.